Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. And thanks to Mark Dwyer for joining us as well. He has been with us many times. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. He's a speaker, educator, author, and has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. So we're going to be talking with him in part about the new interest in gardening, but also take your gardening questions or comments as we move along. And I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Mark Dwyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Have you been getting a lot of questions from first-time gardeners this year?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's with all the negativity, understandable negative news with COVID-related issues, one of the things that I maybe should have seen coming was the fact that it inspired some folks to get a little more involved at home, whether it was with a landscape upgrade or even new gardeners that have decided, you know, it'd be a good year to get outside and grow some tomatoes. And you know, to your original question, lots of interest and lots of questions, particularly for new gardeners.
Well, that's good to hear from my point of view, for sure. I wonder, you know, do you think it's going to continue after things, quote, get back to normal?
Well, the hope is that it does, of course. And it was real interesting as a personal experience. I went out in July to buy some plants, and I was just shocked at how few plants were still remaining at our local garden centers and nurseries. Of course, always important to patronize your local garden centers and nurseries, but folks got out there early, and I think those new gardeners became very quick customers. And the hope is that they've learned the joy and the peace and the benefits of gardening, not just perhaps producing food, but it's nice and relaxing, and it reduces stress. And I just heard a fact a couple days ago where it was estimated that there were 25 million new gardeners in the United States this
Ooh.
Year.
Wow.
And that's an impressive number.
Yeah, it is indeed. Well, what advice do you have for folks who – Let's say who would like to, they started, they've got their garden going, and maybe they want to expand it for the next year. What are you giving them for advice?
Well, I think it's important to ask them a lot of questions on what they're interested in doing, you know, the type of gardening. You know, if it's vegetables, that we can kind of lean a certain direction, whether it's using containers or carving out a little bit of bed space. The real danger for any new gardener, regardless of the circumstances, is going too big too soon, meaning committing to a large new bed or border or a huge vegetable garden or, you know, a space that they're not familiar with the maintenance inputs to properly maintain it over time. So I always use the term, you know, take little nibbles, you know, expand your garden in increments so you can absorb the maintenance. The plants are the easy part. That's the icing on the cake, ultimately, to see what people are interested in growing and what's appropriate for their landscapes and yards.
Yeah, for sure. What trends are you seeing when it comes to making gardens more sustainable?
Well, a huge trend, of course, in edibles. You know, edible gardening, growing your own vegetables and herbs and such has been a hot topic for years. But what was also amazing was seed sales hit record high in the United States, vegetable seeds. And before I forget to mention it, I think it's important that people understand next spring will be crazy too. So, you know, order your seeds this winter and get to your garden centers early. But the trends seem to be around edibles. And when we talk about sustainability, you start considering the impacts not only in your little landscape or garden, but how it impacts the environment. And that revolves around protecting the soil, minimizing chemical use or eliminating it if possible, and really understanding the watering needs of your plants. Because we're pounding a lot of water on turf and other areas for a purpose, of course, but for a sustainable garden, ultimately your inputs and outputs really will match. You're not, you know, creating a situation where it's impacting the environment in a negative way.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Well, we have CJ in Racine with a question for you. Let's go there. CJ, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
My wife and I, when we bought our first home several years ago, inherited four fairly large gardens, some spanning the whole length of the property. And one of the things that we've always wanted to do is look to transition to those into all native plants. But we haven't really found some place where we can go either to get guidance, to figure out what plants to buy, or how we should plan on arranging these.
Yeah, the native plant angle, which it's admirable that you're doing that, because I imagine part of your reasoning is, attracting native pollinators and the benefits for the environment. And I think we all know native plants have the additional benefits of having minimal resource needs. You know, they don't need as much water. They're adaptable to our soils. So as you start to develop those spaces, you know, there's certainly a lot of guidance online, but in Wisconsin in particular, you know, I would guide you towards the Prairie Nursery in Westfield is one outfit that does a lot of consultation and gives information on how to develop natural spaces. And there's many other businesses as well that have the expertise to guide you. I will say the warning is just be a little wary. Understand the plants that you're utilizing. That becomes important because the ingredients, that matrix of native plants, has to work well together. And on occasion, there are some thugs that tend to recede quicker or take over space. So it's important not only to include appropriate neighbors, plants that work well together, but be wary of the influx of seeds and plants, weeds that simply don't belong. So it's not necessarily an easy process, but the fact that you're looking for guidance is certainly the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly Prairie Nursery would be a good place to go. There's a lot to consider in something like this. Just the startup is where the most work is, isn't it, Mark? I mean, seedbed, you know, preparing the land for this and so forth takes a fair amount of work up front.
Absolutely. And I'll give you a horror story, you know, hindsight being what it is, at Rotary Botanical Gardens back at its start down in Janesville. This has been 88, 89. The issue was, with their prairie restoration, they pretty much just cleared some land and threw down seed. And what they didn't do was deal with the existing weed base. There were lots of weeds already there just waiting to germinate. So it was years of trying to reclaim space for the natives, which did eventually fill in. But the problem, to your point, Larry, was proper prep, dealing with the weeds early. And, you know, ultimately, it's a matter of getting, again, the right plants that'll fit those beds and do well. But I encourage people not to jump into it until they've got their weeds under control.
Yeah, for sure. And CJ, we're not trying to talk you out of this, for sure, but it's just a reminder that there are things that you need to do. And then once it gets going, then things become a lot easier for you and will become easier for you and your wife. But Prairie Nursery or some of the other nurseries in the state are very good at providing that information. I know you'll learn a lot on the Prairie Nursery website, for example. So thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. I'll get you on pretty quickly, so give a call. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. A listener emailed that they're taking their family barn down, which is on the edge of the Horicon Marsh. Any ideas of how to manage the new landscape? Do you know how to remove or manage the stone foundation and then how to restore natural plants? Wow.
Well, it sounds like an exciting project. You know, as a side note, hopefully you're saving those barn boards or selling them. I mean, that's likely some very good wood. Wood still has some shelf life left to it. But tough to say without seeing the site and knowing the soils in particular. So it's a matter of, again, once the work is done with removing the barn, perhaps getting an assessment with a soil test, really getting a feel for what's there in terms of current plants. And again, to the earlier comments about installing native plants or whatever angle you're headed towards, I can't say enough about early weed control prior to installing new plants.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just wondering about your own business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Do you do this sort of thing? Do you go out and look at landscapes and advise people?
I do. You know, a lot of my business has been consultation, of course, safe, social distanced with current world events. But, you know, my clients have a wide range of interests, whether it's a full landscape plan or a couple questions on how to prune something. And I found that the business really fit a void in simply providing a lot of support and just plain out information beyond, you know, what's available out there. So it's been a blast. I have to say I've been really enjoying it.
Well, Pat in McHenry, Illinois, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry. I always love hearing discussions about native plants and native restoration situations. As you mentioned, I'm in McHenry. I'm part of the WPPC, which stands for Wildflower Preservation and Propagation Committee, totally not for profit. For people in McHenry County and real close to McHenry County, we offer a mentoring program to help people get started, and there's no charge for our consultation. And we work with them, match up a mentor with the interested homeowner who wants to start a small prairie garden, not like acres, but we say a minimum of 10 by 10, 100 square feet to get people learning about them and how to prep the soil, as you mentioned, and appropriate plants for the light conditions and soil conditions and all those kinds of things. We have a website, thewppc.org, that offers tips also along those lines. And there are some sample gardens that people can look at with the plant list there also, and it's all no charge. So I thought I would mention that. We also have a seminar that when COVID isn't around, we have in February, and that's advertised on our website. It's an all-day seminar. We have a plant sale in the spring there again, depending upon the COVID situation. We offer yard walks to people's homes who have put in native plant gardens, and those walks are free of charge. All of that information is on the website, so people could take a look at that as well.
And that's thewppc.org.
Correct.
All right. Well, Pat, thank you very much for calling. Mark, a comment.
I think that's a great start for, you know, in terms of resources. And I will say a shout out to McHenry County. Their conservation district puts on a wonderful series of virtual presentations. And so they're actually, I linked to them through my Facebook, and I'm just amazed at all the offerings they have for the public. So those sort of resources exist, and so it's not reinventing the wheel in terms of an approach for including native plants. And a lot of people think it's just a matter of finding the plants and poking them in, and there really is so much more to that. And that also includes the consideration of if you're going to be purchasing seeds or plants and how it all works together to ultimately have something that becomes low maintenance and beneficial for your landscape.
And Pat, thank you again. Appreciate your call. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, his business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network and Garden Talk. Taking a look at your garden today and talking about, well, the past year perhaps, and what's ahead for next year with our guest, Mark Dwyer, of Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Great to have him along. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. And Vernon in Fond du Lac, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Vernon.
Hey, how you doing, Larry?
Good.
I'd just like you to know you're my comfort food. I drive a truck. I mean, Milwaukee, Oshkosh. Thank you. But what I want to ask you was, we have a little flower bed in front of our house, and it's like 20 inches deep, 8-9 inches wide, but it's just infested with weeds. And there's a couple of hostas in there. If I like dig down like the depth of the spade and then redo the dirt and stuff back in there, would that get rid of like a lot of the weed seeds and stuff? Do you think that's deep enough? Or you can do an above ground deal? Or...
Yeah, okay. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, you know, in terms of dealing with the weeds, one thing, you know, in a situation like that, consider the fact that a lot of latent weed seeds are typically in the top 1 to 6 inches of the soil. So if you were to go a little further down in there and remove all that and replace it, you'd probably be okay. Although concerns would be, number one, the new soil that you're bringing in may have some issues that may be coming in with some weed seeds, depending on where you get it. And the other concern is, you know, with the existing hostas, you may want to consider lifting those out of the ground in spring, rinsing off the roots and just, you know, setting them aside. So you've got those cleaned and then really digging everything out and replacing. You could compost that soil or maybe use it elsewhere because you'd hate to waste it. But aside from some heavy duty chemical use, which it sounds like you want to avoid, what you suggested in terms of manual change over the soil would work. You just have to go depth, decent depth, and a spade depth would probably do it.
Yeah, there you go, Vernon. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Duke in North Prairie, we're on to you now. Hi, Duke.
Good morning. Hi. This season, garden season, we expanded our gardens, and my wife was very hesitant because she's very wise, because she did realize just how much work that was going to be to control the pests and et cetera. And she was out there every day squashing squash bugs and you name it. So, but what they did use a lot of was neem oil, and it seemed to be very helpful. But my question was, is there any data on its like toxicity, and are there any dangers to the use of neem oil? Because, man, we used a lot of it.
Okay.
Great question. Well, you know, when you bring up neem oil, it has certainly a lot of uses. In terms of being environmentally safe, it's one of those chemicals that tends to smother insects and deal with a whole host of problems. Personally, I don't know about its toxicity. You know, with reapplication and a lot of use, I don't know if there's a buildup. That's probably something you'd have to either look up or ask somebody else. I hate to speculate about it. I'm mm-hmm. not going to lie to you. I just Googled it up just to see. And I'm reading something here on a government site that says neem oil poisoning in adults is rare. And I don't know if that means consumption or not. So I'd hate to speculate based on my quick research here. But there is a comment here about it being slightly toxic for fish and other aquatic organisms. So a concern would be perhaps, you know, near waterways and other bodies of water.
And where, what's a good site for Duke to go on to just look into this further, perhaps? What site were you on?
I just Googled up neem oil toxicity. And there's all sorts of government references to it. There were three or four that look real reputable. And again, I'm seeing there is something called neem oil poisoning, but I think that's consumption. You know, used as directed, I don't think there would be an issue, to be honest. But I would just encourage the caller to do a little more research.
Yeah. Okay. There you go, Duke. Thank you very much for calling. Diane in Cornucopia, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Thank you. I have a question regarding a soil test that I took myself this fall. I sent it in to the soil lab in Marshfield. Yep. And I have raised beds, and I mix the soil in a bucket from the 5 raised beds. I have a question regarding the results. One question was the phosphorus is really, really high, is 186. And I haven't been able to find any way that I could lower it, or do I need to worry about it? The second part is about potassium. I'm on the low end. Is that something that I should be trying to bring up a little bit? I guess I have one more question, and that is my organic matter said 8%. Is it because I'm adding too much compost, which I do add a lot of my homemade compost from, you know, we have chickens and that type of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of soils are high in phosphorus here in Wisconsin.
Is it from, it is, I was worried it was from putting on too much chicken manure, you know, composted, because I compost that with garden manure.
That would have been higher nitrogen. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, you know, the issue with phosphorus and phosphates is even the upper levels, and I don't exactly know what that number means, and that's where maybe the soil lab could give a little more information, but high phosphates aren't, they're undesirable in that there's issues with them leaching into waterways and the water table and, you know, a lot of issues like that. So there's quite a few restrictions across the country in terms of using fertilizers with high phosphates. It's not detrimental to plants. I would just avoid any additional fertilizers that are high in phosphates. I don't think your chicken manure is the problem. To Larry's point, that would add a lot more nitrogen. But I, you know, that organic matter, 8%, that's not bad. I don't think you're doing anything wrong. And it sounds like it. Maybe if you're growing vegetables, that's probably not a bad setup you've got going. But somebody a little more in tune with soils and what your test means with the state would probably be able to give you a little more information as well.
Yeah, if you went wrote back to them or emailed the Soil and Plant Analysis Lab. And I'm pretty sure you'd be getting a quick response on that. But I don't think there's anything. I mean, soils, I mean, there's a lot of phosphorus in the grounds in Wisconsin, in many parts of Wisconsin. And so definitely, in fact, in some, at least some areas, I'm not sure if it's the whole state, but there are fertilizers sold that don't have any phosphorus in it. And that's a good thing in some areas for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Diane, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Lucas in Wauwatosa, it's your turn. Hi, Lucas.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment on native prairie restoration, maintenance, and controlled burns. So my mother and I restored maybe an acre and a half of what was just sort of uncontrolled buckthorn growth, which was really nasty, into native prairies over 5-10 years. It was a lot of work, you know, with like the weed comments that you were mentioning. We definitely ran into that. But now all we have to do in the spring, late spring, is do one controlled burn, and that's basically all the yearly maintenance that we do. And we did have to take a class. It's not like you just go and throw a match. That'd be incredibly dangerous, so I'm not saying that. But I just wanted to get your comments on you know, for every prairie restoration, do you recommend controlled burns? Are there blends of prairie plants that you don't have to burn? Yeah, that's all I wanted to get your thoughts on.
Okay.
Well, you know, I can use the prairie at Rotary Gardens as an example. And I think it was important to point out what you mentioned earlier. That's you had a 5-10 year process of establishing that prairie after removing the buckthorn. And, you know, it's not an overnight process. What we found was a controlled burn of our prairie every 2 to 3 years was beneficial for a lot of reasons. First of all, the prairie plants had already set deep roots, so there wasn't an issue of damaging those. We knew all of those would be back. The timing was important, usually in March, April, a dry day with support from the city in terms of, like you say, you don't just throw a match and stand back. There's wind direction, and there's people that know how to do it, and you can get help, certainly. But I think the benefits are myriad, and that's not only does that fire take out some of the invasives that have snuck in, but also that ash helps rejuvenate the soil. And after a good prairie burn, we're looking at this acre and a half of just charred black, and we were able to go in and take out mulberry, buckthorn, multiflora rose, some of the woody plants that had infiltrated. We were hand digging those. And then we got out of the way, and a few weeks later, this haze of green came up, and it was prairie plants. And, you know, again, if people do a little research on the benefits of a prairie burn, it's immense. And there's a danger in leaving a prairie for 15 years that doesn't experience a burn, not only with infiltration of weeds, but ultimately that burn really rejuvenates the prairie itself.
Yeah, it does indeed. And sometimes if you're in situations, there may be a municipality that doesn't allow burns. or maybe it's in a city or something. They can be mowed, but the burn is probably more preferred if you can do it every couple, 3 years. I think I'm repeating what you just said, Mark. But they can be mowed.
Sure. Well, and when our prairie was weedier 25 years ago, we were burning every spring. We were doing it every spring just because the weeds were so bad. But now it's on a three-year schedule. And, I think folks, when they're doing a burn, have to call. You know, you have to make some calls so local fire services know something's happening and they're aware. And it makes sense to have a mow strip around your prairie. There's a lot of things that goes into making sure that prairie doesn't jump. And while you want a nice breeze, you don't want to do it on, 40-mile-an-hour winds. And it's amazing how fast a prairie burns.
It's remarkable. Jim in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Last year, about this time, I lost a very large white pine, and I ended up with this very sunny space. And below the white pine, I had some hostas and some ferns. So I took those out, filled it in with some compost, and bought a product called a Titan Squash Tunnel. So I had this opportunity to do some vertical vegetable gardening, and it kind of turned out okay. I had a little bit of vegetable. I had some pretty good plant growth, but it wasn't great. So I was wondering if you have tips on vertical gardening, or because I had it under a white pine, what I might add to the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, first of all, white pine, it's a tragedy to lose a white pine, of course, a wonderful native tree. I found that the soils under a white pine tend to be a little more acidic due to the pine needles, which is a good thing. Most plants like it a little more on the acidic side. I'm not familiar with the vertical garden you bought. If I could ask the question, was it something that you added more soil to?
No, it's actually a device. It has different poles. And it's about 6 foot tall, and it's a tunnel-like structure that you grow your plants up onto, and it has netting on it. So it was really a pretty cool product, easy to put up. I just wasn't really that successful with the vegetables that I tried to grow. I had some cucumbers that did okay. Squash was sort of, and zucchini, of all things, didn't grow at all.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if there was an issue with a lot of, if there was enough soil volume to host all of those plants. You know, that becomes a challenge, of course. With vertical systems, with shared vegetables, there's a lot of competition through the summer in terms of rooting and moisture needs and stuff. But in terms of soil under a remove white pine, it's not bad. So I don't know that there would be an issue there, although it may warrant a soil test. I'll have to look up that device. I'm not familiar with it, and I feel like I should take a gander and see what it's all about.
Yeah, I'm thinking soil tests would be. I agree with you. I think a soil test would be important for Jim. That's something you could do right now, and send it in to the Marshfield Lab or one of the soil testing labs around the state, and tell them what you're doing. That you're, growing vegetables and given the area size, and you'll get back some recommendations and you'll get back a reading of what your soil is like. Thank you, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to, and by the way, you can join in. I see we have a couple of open lines here. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Paul in Portage County, it's your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. First of all, thanks for taking my call. Love the program.
Thank you.
So I've got kind of this family plot of land. It's been in the family about 30 years. And 30 years ago, it had a uncontrolled burn there. And there's kind of a section, probably about 2 acres, where the fire got really hot, and it's sandy soil to begin with, and only some kind of short scrub grass has grown back in that 30 years in the summertime. I'd like to do some restoration of that area, and I'm curious kind of where I should start.
Well, it sounds like
it sounds like an opportunity. Just to throw in, what do you want to do with it? Is it vegetables or flowers or native plants?
Be nice. Try to give a place for some animals to live.
Okay, I lost the first part, but native. I'm sorry, Paul. Could you repeat what you said?
Yeah, absolutely. Native plants, definitely. Flowers.
Okay.
And grasses, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, with a lot of potential, 2 acres, that's a good amount of space. And with that hot burn, certainly can damage the upper soil profile. So my guess is a lot of that scrub grass is one of the few things that'll take to that sandy soil at this point. It doesn't mean it's necessarily a weed. It actually might be native, but just adapted to that space. And with sandier soils, you have a very sharp drainage in all likelihood. So that's something to keep in mind. But that doesn't necessarily not lend itself to native plants, which, again, are significant rooters and likely would do quite well. We've said it to a couple callers earlier, but I think a soil test would be in order to see what you're up against, because it's not so much about enriching the soil for native plants, but getting a feel for what you have and based on your location, what might be appropriate. So I think consultation with some of these native plant outfits is a good bet after a soil test. But that land can be revived if you do take an angle towards veggies or replanting other plants. But right now, it's still in the process of sort of healing itself, and the plants that are adapted are the ones that are growing there. So just a matter of sizing up what you have.
All right, there you go. And just to add to that, we had mentioned Prairie Nursery, but Mary in Milwaukee emailed to remind us that the Wild Ones organization has many chapters in Wisconsin. It's a wonderful resource for anyone who wants to use native plants, Paul. And if you go online to Wild Ones, all one word, wildones.org, you'll find people in your area for sure. Who you can talk with as well, and their website has a lot of really good information. So Wild Ones is a great organization. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Mary Kay in Cuba City, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. We're looking at putting in a couple landscaping trees in the front of our farmhouse, and we're looking at planting specifically native trees. For Wisconsin, we're looking at the ironwood. I'm just wondering about your opinion about that or suggestions for another idea.
All right. What do you think about ironwood, Mark?
Well, ironwood's a great plant. When you think, though, of mature size, are you leaning towards something that'll get 50, 60 feet tall, something that's nice and rounded for shade?
Wait.
Sorry, Mary, what did you say?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're looking for. Like a height of 30 to 50 feet and a nice shade tree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, no, you know, ironwood is not a bad selection, although ironwood is adaptable into more shady locations as well. So I don't know. It sounds like it's probably a full sun situation. You know, something to also keep in mind in terms of native trees, you know, our state tree in Wisconsin is a sugar maple. And they're not only long-lived, but you get the benefit of fall color and all the benefits of they provide for wildlife. You know, in time, they could exceed that 50 feet, but there's the wide range of wonderful varieties with excellent fall color. And, you know, the consideration of native woody plants, there are selected cultivars or varieties of many of these plants. So whether it's, sugar maple or, you know, some of these other larger trees, again, ironwood will get into that 30 to 40 foot range pretty easily and is excellent. They're fairly slow growing, which is something to consider as well, but there's a wide range of opportunity. You know, keep in mind ultimate canopy size, because I've seen a lot of woody plants placed too close where 10 to 15 years down the road, there's a decision to either move one or remove one just because they become too crowded. So, you know, look to the future in terms of the spacing as well.
All right. Mary Kay, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, speaker, educator, and author. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. questions for him, give a call. We've got open lines to get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Mark Dwyer, speaker, educator, and author. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. And we've taken quite a number of questions. We've had vegetable garden questions, and we've had flower and landscaping questions, native plants. Lots going on today on Garden Talk. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@WPR.org. Kate in Madison emailed, she's trying to grow a large garden. It currently consists of one large bed and many potted plants. At the end of the year, she has to dump the pots. Would you have any idea what to do with the spent soil from all the pots every year?
Well, you know, assuming that the soil is that lightweight potting mix, which is primarily peat moss, and there might be the white flecks of perlite and vermiculite, which are great for drainage. What I do with my pots is with that light soil, I actually put them in the compost pile. You don't want to put a lot of them, but ultimately it can be composted. Or what I'll do is actually put them in a pile, dump them out, because I have about 80 containers out back, so I can't put all of that in the compost pile. And I do remix my soil every year, so I am emptying these pots currently. But I'll create a temporary pile, and then in spring I break it up after it's settled, and I'll use it for low spots out in the turf or other areas where I'm ultimately, creating a raised bed or something of that nature. So it's a shame to see that soil thrown away, because you'll find some use in your landscape.
Oh yeah, I do the very similar thing, and I would encourage you strongly to find another use for it rather than just throw it out, because it's valuable. It's valuable for sure. Mm-hmm. Dana in Plover, it's your turn. Hi, Dana.
Hi, I heard you talking about native trees and referring to cultivars. And my question is maybe a little general. In general, would cultivars be just as beneficial to re-landscaping an area as a regular native for insects and other benefits?
That's a great question, because there's currently quite a bit of debate on the term nativars, which some people aren't huge fans of. Some feel it's applicable. And essentially what a nativar refers to is a native plant for which a varietal selection has been identified and propagated and sold. So, for instance, nativars apply to not only woody plants, but perennials as well. So a great example would be some of the prairie grasses, like little blue stem and big blue stem, that have been selected for better coloration or different habit or shape. In most cases, the short answer to your question is yes. I personally believe they have very similar benefits. One of the issue, though, with varietal selections of some plants is that they're selected because they have double flowers or are sterile or have some other perceived benefit in the landscape. And that may have an impact on our insects and our native critters. So, for example, double flowering plants tend to put a lot of production into the double flowering and not as much into nectar and pollen production. So that would be less beneficial for our native pollinators. But back to the concept of the woody trees, when I think of the 15 to 20 great selection of sugar maple, they were selected based on more intense fall color, lengthy fall color, early fall color. But the benefits of that tree are still the same for our native wildlife. And in most cases with woody plants, that's the case. It's when you get into perennials where you just do a little more research as to their impact and value for our critters.
Yeah, good points. Dana, thank you so much. Stan in Bagley, on to you now. Hi, Stan.
Thanks for taking my call. My question for Mark is, what do I need to know to plant 3, maybe 4 American hazelnut on a hilltop? exposed.
Mm. Well, is this American hazelnut or European?
American.
Okay.
Well, that would be the healthiest cultivar, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, and it should be hardy for you. American hazelnut's quite hardy. And about two blocks away from my house here in Janesville, there's some folks that have a little grove of hazelnuts. Granted, it's not an exposed site, but hazelnut is tough as nails. One of the concerns I should mention is Japanese beetles absolutely love the leaves, so that's something to keep an eye on. They're not very quick growing, so you just have to be a little patient with it. But in terms of that exposed site, I don't think that'll be problematic for you. But if you're planting young specimens, it takes many, many, many years until they start producing the nuts. So just have some patience, enjoy the fall color, keep an eye out for Japanese beetles, and hopefully they'll be productive for you down the road.
There you go, Stan. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Faith in Waupun, your turn. Hi, Faith.
Hi. Yeah, we're having a problem with our raspberries. In the spring, we have them all cleaned out, and my husband puts all kind of mulch in them. And they can get real nice and green in that. And then about the time they're going to start bearing, then we get the blight in them.
Mm.
Now, we've had that the last couple years. And well, we did spray preen in them, but I don't know if it was too late but I don't know if you have any suggestions what would cause that.
So what did the raspberry, what did it look like, or what did the berries or the plants look like?
The leaves, they get real crunchy and they just dry up and
dry up and blow away, sort of.
Right.
Yeah, Mark, what do you think?
Well, you know, when you think about our weather the last 4 years, particularly the last three summers prior to this one, have been uncharacteristically cool and damp, and that's across the state. And I've heard a lot of comments this year in particular about raspberries having issues, not just the leaves, because there's a whole host of mildews and other foliar problems that'll occur, but also that same some of those same mildews infecting the fruit where they're covered with a powdery substance. And, you know, air circulation is important. It sounds like you're doing a great job with the tidying, you know, taking down the old canes and mulching. I think it's just been a characteristic of our weather. But I would encourage you to talk to your local extension agent about other treatments that are safe for the raspberries and then safe for you to, you know, pick and consume the fruit. And so that becomes important if you're leaning towards chemicals.
If you've got a raspberry bed, Mark, how long can you, like what Faith has got here, how long would you think that raspberry bed can survive and produce fruit in abundance?
I think many, many years. I wouldn't say indefinitely because they can get a little tired. You know, rejuvenating the canes, of course, helps out. And sometimes that's varietal dependent, you know, in terms of there's different types of raspberries that take slightly different treatments. But they, you know, 8, 10, 12 years, you should have a very vigorous patch if you treat it right. So it's tough to say what's going wrong, but everything seems to be pointing in terms of, you know, weather conditions, to be honest.
Yeah. Okay. Faith, thank you very much for calling. Joe in Wisconsin Rapids, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. We have a garden. It's about 80 by 120. And we had been using a rototiller for years, and our soil seems to be dead. So we're thinking of trying to restore the soil and not use a rototiller. But one of the soil tests that I'm trying to determine where somebody does it is the soil test to determine the biology that's in the soil to see whether it's healthy. And I was wondering if your guest knew of any labs in Wisconsin that did these biological soil tests.
Hmm.
Well, beyond what the normal soil test provides, I'm wondering if, you know, Larry, to our earlier guest regarding sending a soil sample to the soil lab. I wonder if that would help provide at least some initial information, because by calling it dead soil, you know, that brings up some questions as to what's happened to it in the past and what it needs to be revived. So are you inquiring about something beyond what would be considered a traditional soil test?
Correct. We've done traditional soil tests where, you know, they tell you that the macronutrients and the micronutrients, but I'm trying to find a lab that would do soil tests to determine the amount of fungi and the amount of bacteria that are in the soil.
Mm. Oh. Yeah, well, the short answer is I don't know, although, I think that resource exists somewhere, but I do want to mention your comment about not rototilling, I think, is commendable, because a lot of people assume rototilling is the way to go to prepare a bed, and it is absolutely not in most cases, simply because it destroys soil structure and creates hard pan underneath that 4 to 6 inch depth. And the idea of improving your soil without a rototiller is ideal, because you want to maintain the structure. And it may not just be a simple adding some compost and kind of, you know, forking it in for you. I understand your concerns and wanting to get a little more information, but I truly don't know where I could direct you at this point.
I don't either. Maybe somebody listening can phone in and give us some information. Stay listening, Joe. We'll see if somebody else has an idea, because I don't have one either for sure. Well, stay listening. Let's go to Dan in Mount Horeb. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question about a oak tree. It's about 40 feet high. Earlier this spring, like in May, we had some really strong winds went through, and it broke half the tree off, up about 20 feet. It was a Y, and it just broke the whole one side off, took a couple feet of bark off. So then, like in July, August, the leaves started falling off, and now all the leaves are gone. Normally, the leaves stay on until spring. So I was wondering, is the tree gone? What do you think is going to happen to this tree?
Yeah, that's tough to say, and that's an unfortunate incident, of course. And to your point about the leaves on oak trees, many of the younger oaks will retain that juvenile foliage, so they tend to look dead over the winter with the brown leaves hanging, and it's tough to discern at this point. If you can reach any of the branches on the side that's still going and see if they're pliable, or give them a little scratch to see if there's any green in there, that would at least indicate it's currently alive. But you won't really be able to make an assessment till mid-spring. But at that point in time, the other consideration is, you know, will that crown fill out? And with the damage that's occurred on the tree already with the loss of that major portion, is it still something you want to retain? And I love oak trees, and I think they're universally worth saving if you can do it. But it's tough to say at this point in time unless you can get up there and give it a little scratch and see what's happening.
Yeah. And do you have other oak trees in the area there, Dan?
Yeah, we have another one in our yard, same kind of tree. It lost a few branches off it, too, but not as major as this one. And the other one seems to be doing okay. But
okay,
I
was kind of worried about oak wilt, Mark.
Yeah.
That kind of damage.
Well, yeah, Larry, to your point, oak wilt, you know, a fresh wound on an oak during the growing season attracts the beetles that'll transfer oak wilt as they visit the oak, and that they can make very quick work of anything in the red oak family. So if your oak has pointy leaves, it's in the red oak family. If it has the rounded lobes, it's in the white oak family, which tend to be a little more resistant to oak wilt. But oak wilt can affect trees very quickly, so if that tree is a doornail in spring, I'd be concerned not only about that, but the likelihood of the oak roots connecting between your oaks. That oak wilt can be spread through the roots as well. So something worth assessing. And there perhaps is a way to send a sample and determine if it has oak wilt. But tough to say if it's alive unless you can get a little close and snip some and see if it's still going. But yeah, the wounds carrying over through the growing season likely weren't a good thing for it.
Yeah, for sure. And it's something to keep an eye on that other oak as well. It would be good to know if if the tree is suffering from oak wilt, for sure. And a certified arborist could take a look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you got it, I'd get a certified arborist out there to take a look and Dan and see if, because they would be able to tell and give you some more information. As Mark was saying, that's a pretty valuable tree. It'd be nice if you could keep it, but you may not be able to, and you don't want to lose the other one. So there you go. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Mark Dwyer is our guest today. Speaker, educator, and author. His degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. He is a former director of horticulture at Rotary Gardens in Janesville. His business now is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Take a look at his website. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Dwyer, speaker, educator, and author, degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry, and his business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. So, what gardening questions do you have? Join in, give a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And, Mark, we had a call from Marie who says that, and this is in relation to the former caller who wanted a different kind of soil test to look at the kind of the, not just the nitrogen, phosphorus, and so forth levels, but the sort of the biological nature of the soil that he has. Mm-hmm. And Marie says he should get the Haney soil test, H-A-N-E-Y, Haney soil test. There are no labs in Wisconsin. She thinks the closest one is in Nebraska. And then she says, and don't forget to plant a cover crop each year to that soil, which is a good mm-hmm. idea, too.
Mm-hmm.
So the Haney soil test, I didn't know that test. Worth a look.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. That's interesting.
Denny emailed to suggest the caller who was the same thing of the health of the soil. Watch the documentary Biggest Little Farm. The farm has had great luck with compost tea. So the documentary Biggest Little Farm. So it's another suggestion there. Rachel emailed to say they are building a new home on 1 acre in the Fox Valley, Appleton area. What do you suggest for a modern, full, and natural privacy fence along a busier road? They are looking for quick growing and full coverage.
Well, you know, it brings up a couple additional questions. You know, along a roadway, you have to consider salt spray. You know, if it's a certain distance away and it's faster traffic, there might be an issue of some salt. And I know that area has a lot of red clay. You know, there's in terms of soils, that's some heavier soil. So that also becomes a factor. But the idea of a hedge or a living fence makes sense. You know, something like arborvitae are quick growing. That also assumes not having a deer issue, you know, that because they certainly love arborvitae. But if it's full sun situation, yeah, you know, a hedge of junipers or, you know, the likelihood of an evergreen would give year-round screening. And I'm going on these mini tangents, but when I think of year-round screening, you have to consider wind flow too. Does that create stagnancy of the air in the space depending on which way the wind is going? So, you know, a quick screen, again, I would lean on the evergreens I've mentioned, but keep all the challenges of salt, the type of soil, and the consideration of wind direction in your calculations.
Kay in Waterford emailed to say that she's had problems with iris borer. Is there anything she should be doing this fall to help prevent problems next year?
Well, the iris borer is a perpetual and perennial problem. It when you think you've gotten rid of it, it tends to come back. And there are ways of saving your rhizomes by digging them up and making some sharp cuts and removing the borer. I would encourage her to connect with the Wisconsin Iris Society. There's some very knowledgeable folks, and iris borer is an issue for many people around the country. But it can be managed. When not managed, it's extremely problematic and just decimates an iris patch repeatedly. But there are ways of contending with it.
Faye in Waupun, we'll go to you now. Hi, Faye. Thank you for calling.
I have a question. On the east side of my house, I had my house painted this summer, and I had these huge green bushes that the guys had to pull out. They've been there forever. And I have to replace them with something. I want to have something in the greens, you know, evergreen type thing that I can see green year round. And I like old school things.
Okay.
Do you have any ideas?
What do you think, Mark?
Well, you know, in the east side of the home, we're talking morning light here. And in terms of green, you know, evergreens that are traditional or classic, you can't go wrong with yews. You know, yews are quick growing, easy to maintain. There's a wide range of them out there, including some nice upright forms now that are a little more narrow, if that kind of fits the bill. We just talked about arborvitae as a hedge, but arborvitae, there's some globular forms as well, rounded forms that look real sharp and also can be maintained at a certain height. And those are two classics that are tough as nails on the east side of a home. The lighting is probably a little more limited for most of the other evergreens, but there's a wide range of both yews and arborvitae that I think would fit your need for a shrub.
Yeah, I think so, too. Thank you, Faye, for calling. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Open lines. Let's see. Kate in Madison. Actually, I'm sorry, not Kate in Madison, Ryan in Denmark. Let's go there. Ryan in Denmark emailed to ask if he should cut his lawn lower than normal at this time of the year or if he should grow it longer.
Well, there's some debate on that. It's a great question. My personal opinion on it is my last cut at home and our last cut at Rotary Gardens was short and at about 2-2.5 inches. And there's not a real danger in leaving it long. We just wanted a clean look and didn't want a lot of matted down turf in the spring, which might be problematic with some early start of diseases and things like that. So there's two schools of thought on it, but my opinion is go short with your last mow.
That's what I do, too. Mm-hmm. It's, I don't know. It's just what I've done, and I'm continuing to do for
yep.
sure. And I'll still have another, you know, next week, I think it's supposed to get to 50 degrees at some point. So during the week, so that might be getting closer to the last mow for sure. Joel
yep.
in Green Bay. Hi, Joel. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Question for you about, I've got a maple tree, pretty good sized one in the front yard, and the roots are, you know, starting to come up out of the ground and the kids are tripping on them and stuff. Can I cover those with dirt? And if so, how much can I put on top without damaging the tree?
Well, you know, great question. You know, the shallow roots of maple are always problematic. And I wouldn't encourage you to even try simply because adding any volume or depth of soil over existing roots ultimately is detrimental. In the past, some folks have said you can add a little bit if you're just trying to grow, get some grass seed growing, but I still wouldn't do it because the issue with the continued growth of the maple tree is all those roots are going to get thicker too and then continue to emerge out of whatever soil you've added, which again, I wouldn't bother doing. It gets to a point where when it's tough to grow grass under a maple tree, part of it, the issue is lighting, of course, but the rooting challenges, the competition is fierce. So that's when folks start leaning on drought-tolerant perennials and other ground covers that can take that competition. And that was a lot of words to really say I wouldn't recommend doing any soil over the roots.
All right, there you go. I agree again with you on that, Mark. Mike emailed that he has advanced degrees in soil science. He's worked on manure issues, and we did have a question about this. Manure is high in phosphorus relative to nitrogen, so it is an unbalanced fertilizer that leads to high soil phosphorus levels. The caller needs to decrease their manure use and find nitrogen and potassium inputs. A good source of potassium is ashes. Comments on that?
Pardon?
Comment on that?
It's tough to say because I think the caller had mentioned using a lot of chicken manure, which
that's high in nitrogen
for sure. So, you know, I think the advice on getting a soil test and getting a feel for what's happening there beyond, I think she had already had a soil test. So it's a matter of just knowing what you have. He is right though. Certainly with manures, you never know what you're going to get because it depends on the type of manure, how long it's been aged, how much you add. So there's a lot of variables with that, and there is a danger in overdoing it without a doubt. So you do need to be careful with your amendments and how they relate to modifying pH and that NPK ratio as we've discussed.
Bill in Oregon emailed that he has a 10 by 15 area that's been dedicated to a monoculture of cup plants for about a decade now. In recent years, he's noticed a reduction in successful flowering, with many flower heads wilting or blackening. His concern is that this repeated monoculture is leaching a key nutrient or mineral from the area, and wonders if you can recommend any soil amendments that might reinvigorate cup plants or be beneficial to prairie flowers in general.
Well, that's interesting. You know, we've used the phrase get a soil test a lot today, but you know, cup plants are, first of all, tough as nails, and as a native plant, they're deeply rooted, they're drought tolerant, and so it surprises me. If someone had come to me with that comment, I'd say, well, that's weird, because I know at the prairie at Rotary Gardens, the cup plants have been there 30 years. Now, it's not a monoculture of those. There's a lot of other things going on, and there's a prairie burn involved, as we had alluded to earlier. So it's tough to say based on the comments, but my guess is some sort of rejuvenation, some sort of organic amendments, or adding even shredded leaves over the top. Despite the dangers of the manures we just discussed, having a well-aged manure, a light coating probably wouldn't hurt. But as a tough plant that can take lean soils, you don't want to overdo it with amendments because you can get extremely tall, lanky, and top-heavy plants. So I think that soil test is still warranted to see if there's something real specific going on. But it's a beautiful plant and great for pollinators.
And would you recommend a burn on an area like that, a 10 by 15 area?
It absolutely wouldn't hurt. And if it's not been done, that might be something to try in the earliest of spring and see if that, you know, if that helps rejuvenate the patch.
Yeah, for sure. Mary in Fort Atkinson, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I heard you talking about raspberries.
Yeah.
And last summer, we had a lot of new growth. And then this spring, nothing there. And I was wondering if the rabbits could be eating, those new bushes.
Absolutely. You know, just despite the thorns, rabbits and deer will nibble on them. There's a lot of critters that would certainly do that. Although you'd likely would see some evidence, whether it's the nibbled canes that had emerged or some rabbit poop here and there. But there are critters that'll nibble. But to our earlier comments, you know, raspberries have had a tough go with some of the weather, too. So the hope is that you get a nice resurgence next year, and hopefully these problems are, you know, something of the past, and your patch recovers to its former glory.
Yeah. Yep. Good luck, Mary. Thank you. Michelle wondered, she emailed to ask where she can get soil tests.
Well, I think, you know, I would contact your county extension office. We'll guide you directly, and they carry the bags and give you the information on how to take the test and where to send it. I think that's your best bet, is that test to the soil science lab.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's see. You can join in, too, by the way, 800-642-1234. Kathy emailed to ask if she should put styrofoam covers over plants, and if so, which ones?
I have a personal opinion on that. When you think of styrofoam as they relate to rose cones, I don't like using any of that because the insulation isn't about necessarily keeping the plants a little bit warmer. It's about making sure the soil underneath remains frozen in the winter. It's about making sure that the March freezing and thawing doesn't become such an issue in damaging the plant. And the danger with the styrofoam insulation is it gets quite hot with full sun, even in late winter. And the problem is it tends to, there's a lot of soil temperature fluctuations. There's an air circulation issue, even with some venting holes. I'm rambling on here, but I am not a huge fan of any of the styrofoam. If you want to insulate some plants, consider a light mulch, some shredded leaves, some evergreen boughs, some straw, and something you can peel off later. But again, your intent with using these is keeping things frozen, not keeping things warm.
So you wait till the ground's frozen and then you put them on.
Right. You'd be wanting, I can talk about southern Wisconsin here. We wait till after Thanksgiving to really do that. We wait till the ground is as hard as a rock, and then we'll address that mulching.
Connie in Portage called to say she planted bridal wreath bushes on the east side of her house, and they were beautiful for that other person who was calling about the east side of their house. Bridal wreath bushes.
Yeah, the bridal wreath spireas are gorgeous, and they can take quite a bit of shade, and they have a nice arcing form, and that's great for that side of the house. I thought the caller was more interested in a conifer, a classic evergreen, but in terms of beautiful white arcing flowers in spring, the bridal wreaths are dynamite, although they can get quite large in time, which is something to keep in mind.
Rich in St. Francis would like your thoughts on pampas grass.
Well, pampas grass, we can't grow in Wisconsin. True pampas grass is not hardy unless you're down in southern Illinois and further south. So there are pampas grass-like plants, like miscanthus or maiden grass, also called Japanese feather grass. So there are some pampas grass-like ornamental grasses that get the beautiful inflorescences, the plumes late in the season. Be careful with miscanthus because there are some spreaders. So you want to identify some varieties that are clumping, but again, offer that pampas grass-like appearance.
All right. Good information there. Well, we'll take an email from Eileen. They're looking to remove a huge silver maple tree in their yard. They don't have access to a certified arborist without paying a very large fee for travel time. One company that removes trees in their area suggests leaving the stump for 1 year before removing it. Another company removes the stump along with the tree. Is there a best practice? Do they also have the roots that are in the yard removed? They are tripping hazards.
Well, the challenge with silver maple is, first of all, it's soft-wooded. So I think the advice of, you know, once a big portion of the tree is gone, leaving the stump, it for a year, it'll soften up a little bit, but I don't know that will ultimately reduce the cost of having that removed the next spring or a year later. But the comment about all the roots, when a tree that size is removed and the stump is ground out, you know, a stump grinder, it typically does the silhouette of the trunk and some of the larger buttress roots. So if there's shallow roots a great distance from that central trunk, they can also be ground out, but it's a added expense and it's a huge amount of mess. So typically it's just the trunk that's ground out and then you clean it up. You know, the danger too is getting some resprouting from the roots, which happens with poplars and some other plants, but hopefully that silver maple, my advice, and I know it's costly, but I would get the whole shebang taken out and if you're committed to removing it, get that stump ground out and then see what else may pop up or what else may happen, and let that spot settle once you've cleaned it up. Let it settle for a year because as the roots decay, that original spot will sink down.
Val in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was just calling to follow up with the comment on the raspberries. The family loves raspberries. The raspberry canes only last 2 years. They bloom in spring and the fall, so the most you're going to get as far as, you know, blooms, raspberry batches, is maybe four batches, and then the cane dies. And I found in our backyard that you have to let raspberries hit the ground. Otherwise, you're not going to have that continual regenerated growth on its own. And if you don't corner them off in an area, raspberries can quickly take over a huge area. We were able to go out and pick 2 to 3 pints a day all summer long. Raspberries, they're a very good fruit to grow, but the canes only last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to your comment, when the canes are arcing and touching the ground, you get some regeneration. And I've seen raspberry patches, you know, kind of bordered off along, say, a chain link fence, and then they're rooting out, coming up in adjacent turf, 5, 10, 15 feet away. So they can sucker out immensely, but that regeneration, ultimately, you hope to have a regenerated patch, or you can insert new canes as you go.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, Deborah, maybe in the last 40 seconds or so, emailed for suggestions for fruit trees or other edibles for an urban garden in Madison.
Yeah, it kind of depends on your space. And, you know, certainly there's, apples, and there's compact form of apple trees and uprights, and some that are espaliered or started to be trained to go against a wall. So it's a matter of what sort of space you have. I have some friends in Madison that have an unbelievable peach tree in their backyard that has a lot of winter wind protection, but very productive. But you can get into plums and cherries, and there's all sorts of amazing edibles. The limitation of space, though, if that's a consideration, would lean you towards researching, again, more compact or bush forms or upright forms, just to maximize your space while still having, you know, productive plants.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Well, Mark, it's always a pleasure to have you come by. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to your next visit. You been busy yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Yep, lots of consultations, and, you know, I'm excited to continue to help people. And whatever we can do as gardeners to help, you know, encourage the next generation of gardeners, particularly kids, let's do it. It's an opportunity to certainly get involved.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Mark Dwyer, his business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. So you can go online to his website and take a look. He's got lots there. Always great to have him with us, and he'll come back and be with us again. I'm sure of that. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Tova Martin will be back to answer your indoor gardening questions. You can listen at 11 on Friday, at 6 a.m. on Saturday, or you can listen, what the heck, online at any time. And I hope you'll join us Monday when our physical therapist will be back to talk about options for exercising at home. That's at 11. In the meantime, I hope you'll stay with us. There's lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.